Today at Reader's Corner, Jeffrey Wilhelm, author of Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them.
If you were to say to me, aren't some books bad? I would go, no. You have to figure out what the kids are doing with the book before you could figure out how good it is or if it might be deleterious in some way. Basically, what we found is there are very specific benefits to specific genres that are meeting these kids' human developmental needs at the very point of that need. Not only do I think teachers can leverage this research, but certainly kids who read a lot will become better readers and will read more complex texts later on in their lives. That's what real readers do.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Research shows that kids who read well do better in school and have a distinct advantage in developing communication and logical thinking skills. Avid readers also tend to be more engaged in the world around them. But how do you get young people to want to read? Today's guest, Jeffrey Wilhelm, believes that kids and adolescents should be allowed to choose at least some of the books they read for school so that their reading adds meaning to their lives. Dr. Wilhelm is an internationally known teacher, author, and presenter, and the founding director of the Boise State Writing Project. His new book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them, argues that books normally categorized as on the fringe can engage young readers and promote imagination, satisfaction, and social action. In Reading Unbound, Dr. Wilhelm and co-author Michael W. Smith analyze popular teen genres from romance to dystopian fiction to horror and explain what makes them so attractive to young readers. Each chapter also offers tips for educators on how to integrate these texts into the mainstream curriculum and even use them to meet Common Core standards. Dr. Wilhelm joined Boise State's faculty in 2003 and is a professor of English education. He is the author or co-author of 24 books about literacy and literacy education, and he talked about some of his earlier research as a guest on our program in 2005. Dr. Wilhelm joins me in the studio for today's interview. Jeff Wilhelm, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Man, it's been a while, but we'll pick right up here. Let's just start with your subtitle, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want. What's behind this? What's the deal?
You know, when Michael and I were analyzing the data, we kind of came up with this mantra that kids tend to read what they need. And I would say the central finding of our study, which we did with 14 eighth grade readers and then later on with 14 high school readers, was that the kids choose to read what they love to read precisely because it fulfills human developmental needs that they have at that moment in time and helps them rehearse for how to deal with those particular needs and challenges.
Now, one of the things that I found really interesting about your book, and I would strongly recommend this book to parents, maybe even grandparents who want to keep an eye on their grandchildren, but especially parents who are trying to figure out how to get their kids to read more. This is perfect. But what I noticed when I was looking at the copyright is that Scholastic here has a statement that I seldom see in books that says Scholastic grants teachers permission to photocopy the reproductible pages from this book for classroom use, which shows that Scholastic obviously intends to sell a lot of these books to school districts for teacher budgets so they can use them and become better teachers in the class. But again, back to my point, this is also a great resource for parents. Could you comment on the role you think that book will play in the life of a parent trying to work through how to take a kid away from a video game and get him to sit down with a book? And you might also comment on the relationship between a video game and the book.
Well, I'm glad you asked that because I wrote the book not only as a professor and researcher into reading and as a teacher, but as a parent. I've got one daughter who actually was in the study, who's a huge fan of Harry Potter and a huge fan of dystopian novels. I've been worried about that. You know, she began back in the day when in first and second grade reading a series of unfortunate events by Lemony Snicket and wouldn't come to dinner and read underneath the blankets. And I worried, you know, these are dark books. You know, is this okay? Is it psychologically healthy? You know, and as a father of young women and a teacher of young women, that obviously is a concern. I've had a free reading program in my classes for 32 years, and I still work in schools where I promote this kind of work. And when you talk to parents, it's hard to explain their intensity. And what, in the beginning of my career, it was the Babysitter's Club and R.L. Stein, you know, and now it's Harry Potter and the Hunger Games. And the parents will say, can't you get him to read something else, something better? And it's almost as if I'm mainlining the kids' junk food or something. And I didn't really have a response other than to say it's a free reading program. Real readers choose what they want to read. But I couldn't go back to any data and say these are actually the benefits of these particular kinds of text. So that was the genesis of the study. And basically what we found is there are very specific benefits to specific genres that are meeting these kids' human developmental needs at the very point of that need. So I'm feeling much more sanguine and much more relieved, maybe, and much more enthusiastic as a parent and as a teacher about The Hunger Games, about Harry Potter, about romances, about these books that used to frankly worry me quite a bit.
So you were about to go to press with this book, and you point out in your book that all of a sudden a UK study comes out, a major research study, and you said, hold the press. We absolutely have to get this study in the book. Tell us what's so significant about this new research.
You're referring to the British cohort study, which is a very fascinating study. They took 18,000 people who were born in the same week in the United Kingdom across England and Wales and Scotland, and they have followed them since 1970. And they have studied several metrics, pleasure reading being one. And what we found so amazing was that pleasure reading was explanatory more than any other factor of socioeconomic status and educational attainment and life satisfaction and many factors. And it was of a magnitude three times greater than the parents' socioeconomic status, social achievement, and educational attainment. So it was hugely explanatory, more so than any other factor in the study, of people's educational attainment and success. What was interesting as well is that it even explains math achievement. The more you read for pleasure, the better your achievement in math. And the authors explain this by saying that that's because pleasure reading leads to cognitive progress over time more than any other factor they could identify.
So I'm sure there's some parents listening to you talk about these horror books and these dystopian novels and their romance novels. And if they read the book, they'll learn a lot more about that. But I'm sure that there's some that are thinking, yeah, right, I don't buy it. So let's start with the horror books. They're by far the most popular genre among junior high school students. What is their appeal and why is it okay?
Well, it was very interesting that the kids who were most attracted to horror were kids who really didn't like reading much of anything else and sometimes were considered to be struggling students by their teachers and in their schools. What we found was that horror allowed you to deal directly and consciously with various anxieties and fears and acted as what depth psychologists would call a container for those anxieties so that they could be brought into consciousness and studied and dealt with. I'm reminded of Carl Jung, the famous depth psychologist, whose favorite quote was from St. Thomas, who said, "That which is repressed and kept in the darkness, if it remains in the darkness, will destroy you, but if brought out into the light, will redeem you." And, of course, Carl Jung devoted his life to bringing out those unactualized parts of ourselves that we tend to repress for various reasons and bring them into the light so we can integrate them into our personality and become a full human being. And that's exactly what the kids were doing with these horror novels. Now, again, a lot of the kids were not what you would call great students, and yet they were very articulate about why they loved horror and how it helped them to deal with fears that were external to themselves, but also fears that were internal to themselves, like being inadequate or not becoming the kind of person they wanted to be or succumbing to certain temptations. And they read the horror books almost allegorically, you'd have to say. And I was very, very impressed. One boy said, "It's like exploring the darkness without a flashlight. And the darkness is eternal and long-lasting." And, you know, he was expressing that, you know, I'm going into the depths. I'm trying to figure out what's going on underneath me, what my anxieties are, and whether I should be so anxious about those things or whether I might be able to deal with them in a more healthy way.
You're listening to Jeffrey Wilhelm. He is a professor of English education at Boise State University, and we're talking about his book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. I was reading the part of your book where you talked about what you read as a kid, and it was about the Hardy Boys. And I remember reading about biographies of American patriots. It's a far cry from romance, horror, or dystopian novels. And so I guess I just have to ask, is this really a relatively new phenomenon, or were you and I just reading the wrong thing in those days?
Well, I think I actually would have fit in the study very well, because mysteries are a kind of subgenre that I think are marginalized. They're certainly not embraced in school very often. You don't see them taught. You don't see them on summer reading list. And I was ripping through these things. I think there were 81 original books. I owned them all in the original leather-bound versions. My mother sold them all in a book sale, in a yard sale when I was in college.
I
never could really come to forgive her. I loved the book so much. And what's interesting in reflecting back, I engaged in all five pleasures that we identified in the study. First of all, it was just fun to live through the stories and solve the mystery with Joe and Frank and their friend Chet. And I often imagined I was Frank. I often imagined I was another friend along with Chet helping them out. This is what we call in the study immersive play pleasure, where you live through the story and it doesn't look for any other satisfaction other than that live through experience. We found that that was prerequisite to all the other pleasures. Other pleasures we found were work pleasure, you know, that you have a functional application for what you've read. And I remember thinking a lot as a kid about, well, what am I seeing as clues? What's going on here? You know, almost playing the Sherlock Holmes game of, you know, that the Hardy Boys taught me how to do. That's very important when you're a reader. You know, you have to infer, you have to analyze. When you write, when you're a researcher, I could almost trace my love of being a researcher back to the Hardy Boys, about looking at all the data and trying to figure out what doesn't count and what does count and connecting the dots. I also rehearsed a lot about being the kind of person I want to be, which we called inner work study, and was the most significant finding in the study, was that the kids were very consciously using their reading to become the kind of people they wanted to be. You know, I was very devoted to being loyal, like Frank and Joe were, to living a good life for the good and against evil and for justice and fairness. And that's what those books were about, and it helped me rehearse becoming that kind of person I wanted to be. Another pleasure is the intellectual pleasure of figuring things out. Mysteries clearly play into that. But whenever you're inquiring as a researcher or as a learner in school, you're having to figure things out. You're having to put the puzzle pieces together. You're having to figure out how do all these things go together to create some kind of meaning and effect. And finally, there's the social pleasure. I remember Bobby Fischer, Brett Bartolovich, my friends in third and fourth grade. We read these books together. We traded the books together. We talked about them together. We dramatized the stories together. But there was also the social pleasure of relating to the characters and the social pleasure of relating to the authors. We found all those kinds of pleasure in the study among every one of these readers of marginalized texts. They engaged in every one of those pleasures. And when I say pleasures, we're not just talking fun. We're talking hard fun. Figuring stuff out, figuring out who you are, figuring out who you want to be, figuring out the life challenges you got to overcome. The books were amazing in helping the kids on that journey, doing all the things I would want for my kids as a parent or as a teacher.
So how does a novel like The Hunger Games, a dystopian novel, how does that book help young readers understand the world they live in?
Well, the dystopian readers always read the books as allegories. My daughter, Jasmine, was one of the dystopian readers, and she said, you know, Dad, it just gives you someone to root for. A little later in an interview, she said, it reveals what really is that we kids have to know about. And she said, adults have screwed up the world, which is a typical teenage attitude, but it's going to be up to us to fix it. She read a lot of ecotopian novels. Of course, The Hunger Games has a lot to do with environmental degradation. She saw the Occupy Wall Street movement as a correlative of Katniss and the Resistance, you know, fighting against these corporate moneyed interests. She talked a lot about income inequality and how that was something that was explored in The Hunger Games. And of course, Obama, you know, made that a big part of his State of the Union address. Economist Krugman are writing about this widely, about how this is a threat to democracy. Joseph Stiglitz, who was here as a distinguished speaker at Boise State, that was a big part of his speech there. You know, Jasmine had never heard of those people, and yet the Hunger Games was inducting her into that conversation. What kind of equality do we need to be a democratic society, and how can I be part of that project?
Well, the romance novel is clearly viewed the most negatively, and you're the father of two daughters, and you're the guy that wrote this book, so help us with how you came to grips with the romance novel being okay.
Well, the romance did worry me as much as any genre that my kids read, both my own children but also my students. And I really, I think, underestimated what it is that is involved in a romance. Or, perhaps I should be more precise, in reading a romance. Because a central finding of our study was the kids weren't eating these books. They weren't consuming them. They were operating on them. And so if you were to say to me, aren't some books bad? I would go, no. You have to figure out what the kids are doing with the book before you could figure out how good it is or if it might be deleterious in some way. The romance readers we studied were rehearsing healthy relationships. They were rehearsing their own boundaries, where they were going to draw the line in the sand in their relationships. They were rehearsing what they wanted in a partner. They were rehearsing overcoming necessary difficulties and life challenges in relationship. They were rehearsing, as one girl said, seeing and valuing the personhood of the self and the other person. It was about becoming the best possible self in relationship, which is another quote from a romance reader. The romance readers in our study were very insistent the romance had to be real. They kept saying that it has to be a real romance. And that's actually the title of that chapter about romance. And what they meant by real was there's going to be problems and you're going to have to work through them. Now, they knew, and this was something I said to them, look, you know the ending. What's the fun? They go, oh, the fun is how you get to the ending. What challenges do you have to overcome? That's what you want to read about. And they would really discount books where they didn't feel like the challenges were big enough or that the people weren't serious enough about the other person to overcome those challenges. Interestingly, Janice Radway, who's a professor at University of North Carolina, wrote a book called Reading the Romance back in the 80s where she studied Midwestern women who were adults and mothers. And she found that they had many creative ways of using their romance reading to promote their family, to try to transform their husband into being a more loving, giving, whole human being. That's how they looked at this. But they also looked at it as the man transforming the woman, becoming more whole and complete together.
As I listen to you describe the reaction of these subjects of yours, let's call them, they're fairly sophisticated analyses of their readings. So maybe we should stop here and have you tell us about your subjects, your research subjects, that is. Who are we talking about here, age-wise, numbers, where they come from? Where did you go to find this information?
Well, Bob, I'll answer as far as I can while still protecting the rights of the human subjects.
Sure.
14 of the kids were from the Pacific Northwest and were in eighth grade. They all self-nominated to be in the study. So they said, we read books that make our parents and teachers nervous. And we really love them and we'd like to talk about them. Another, because we became so interested in the specific genres, we recruited 14 older readers from high school from the Pacific Northwest to do the second part of the study. So those were the kids. Now, I've been studying kids' reading for 25 years now, and in every study I've ever done, I'm surprised at how articulate kids are and how well they speak about these internal processes of reading. And I've learned as a teacher, and it stood me in good stead as a researcher, if kids are intrigued by something or emotionally charged by something or engaged by something, ask them why. And you're going to learn a lot. Now, you not only have to ask them directly, you have to ask them indirectly. And we had a lot of interview protocols, and we had them do think alouds of their reading. We had a lot of ways to get at it, both directly and indirectly. Let me give an example. My daughter, Jasmine, she would always say to me, Dad, don't ruin it for me. I just like Harry Potter, right? So the direct thing wasn't working that great. So then I would say, well, Jasmine, who's your favorite character? She'd go, Hermione, duh. And I go, well, what do you like so much about Hermione? And she goes, she's the best friend ever, duh. And she was wearing these bracelets, what would Hermione do, you know? And she'd say, hey, when you're in a trouble with a friend, you look at that bracelet and you think, what would Hermione do? She has it going on as a friend. So notice how she's basically says, I just like it, immersive play pleasure. But immediately upon asking her, who's your favorite character? She's doing the inner work. how can I become the friend I want to be and use Hermione as my inspiration? And they looked to Harry Potter as being about imagination, as, hey, there are all these problems out there. You know, there are Voldemorts. There are vampires. There's evil out there. There are challenges. We're going to need all our imagination, all our social imagination, all our problem-solving capacities to solve this. And Harry and Ron and Hermione together form a triumvirate of people working together to be smarter than and more powerful than any of them are individually through their friendship to solve these seemingly insurmountable problems. Jasmine said, you know what I love about these books? They give you hope because we know the world has all these problems. You need hope. Katniss gave her hope. She goes, she is the kind of person I want to become who does not give up, who resists, who says this stops here. You know, they saw these characters as being very inspirational, functional work and inner work in the way they did it.
You're listening to Jeffrey Wilhelm. He is a professor of English education at Boise State University, and we're talking about his book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. Where do these students go from here in terms of their next level of reading experience? Maybe that's the next research project you do as you follow these kids through college or through young adulthood to determine just, do these kids become the readers of great literature that English professors wish they would become or not?
I will say yes. And that's not based on our own data, but data that already exists that finds that if people are passionate readers of formulaic fiction, if they are passionate readers of popular fiction throughout their lives, they tend to outgrow themselves and they tend to look for new, more challenging kinds of text. In fact, we know this from studies of motivation, that people are always looking to be in their zone of proximal development, to be just beyond their capacity. That's what's fun, to be outgrowing yourself, to undertake the new challenge. Think of yourself if you're a whitewater kayaker, you know, you want the next hardest thing. You know, if you're a runner, you want the next hardest race. It was the same thing with these readers. They were always looking for the new challenge. I had a, for instance, when I was working in a Boise school, and we were going to read 1984, and the kids were not that excited. And I said, hey, it's the Hunger Games. It's the Hunger Games for my generation. They go, no. And I go, oh, yeah. You know, the Ministry of Truth is like Pan Am. And, you know, and so, and I said, I tell you what, I will read the Hunger Games if you will read the 1984 with me. So I read the Hunger Games and we talked about it. And then I said, okay, you're going to be amazed at the parallels. And they go, okay. You know, and then what we had is this conversation that was so rich around 1984 because they could use the Hunger Games, which is a dystopian novel, and so is 1984, to think about 1984. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we bridge from the things kids already care about and already know to get them to do the things we wanted them to do? You know, if we start with the things we want them to do, that's often like giving them cod liver oil. They don't want to do it. They're going to resist it. But if you connect it to what they already know and care about, you're going with the flow of motivation. And so, yeah, not only do I think teachers can leverage this research, but certainly, I'll say unequivocally, kids who read a lot will become better readers and will read more complex texts later on in their lives. That's what real readers do. You know, if you only read what is assigned in school, you're not a real reader. Real readers read what's in school to do the schoolwork, but they read what other people are reading so they can talk to them, and they read a lot of things that are of their own choice. If we want to help kids be real readers, we must help them to make choices and to forge their own reading lives.
Well, you know, you have three takeaways at the end of the book for teachers, and I couldn't help but think, my gosh, this sounds exactly like what adults do in book clubs. But let's take them one at a time, three different approaches. The first is the chance to talk. What do you mean by that?
Well, I tell this to my student teachers who I work with here at Boise State. The person doing the talking and doing the thinking and doing the activity is the one learning. John Goodlad, in his famous book, A Place Called School, says, school is a place where young people go to watch old people work. And I tell my students, that's a bad thing. Any work you do ought to be an immediate service of the kids doing the work. Well, set up situations where they're talking, where they're doing the intellectual work, where they're constructing the meaning and the understandings. Here's an example of that. If you reframe curriculum as inquiry, if you say, we're not doing Romeo and Juliet, we're doing what makes and breaks relationships. And we're going to read Romeo and Juliet together to get after that. Newsflash, that's why Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet. He didn't write it to torture ninth graders. He wrote it to figure out what screws up relationships. And if you ask that question of Romeo and Juliet in the first act, you're going to get familial and parental interference. Could that still be happening? gang membership, you know, still going on. Deceit, religion, all these things still obtain today. Now, you could set up literature circles for the kids and say, hey, we got some romance readers in here. They're going to do some advertisements. If you'd like to read one of their books with them, you're going to look at the same question and bring to the rest of the class what you're learning. We had girls in the study reading this black literature, shock literature, Chuck Palahniuk, also about relationships. Hey, if you want to read one of hers, read in that literature circle. Bring what you learn back to bear. Vampire novels are quite often romances. What are you learning about the nature of relationships, the challenges, what breaks them, screws them up? And then the kids become experts. The kids are the ones who are teaching each other. The kids have to do the talking. Your job as the teacher, then, is to promote the engagement, which you're doing through that structure, but also help them become better readers, which you're doing by connecting it to the inquiry theme, comparing it to Romeo and Juliet. And I'm just saying, if you do that, you're meeting all 10 of the Common Core reading anchor standards.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a way to get the kids to talk.
Mm-hmm. So the second approach, let them choose. And I would add something to that that you mentioned somewhere in the middle of your book, not necessarily all the same book. In other words, mix it up a little bit, but help us understand why that's so important.
I do think it's important for teachers and classes to do some things together, to read some anchor text together so they have this common experience. But I also think it's very important that you have choice. Look, every time you go into a school, every time you look at a policy document, they talk about we have to create lifelong readers. What's the way to create lifelong readers? You're not going to do something in a lifelong way unless you see great value in it and you get great pleasure out of it. And again, that pleasure doesn't have to be just fun, ha-ha. It can be hard work of doing inner work, of doing the functional work, of doing the social work, of doing the intellectual work. But you only do things you find pleasurable. And you are only going to continue to do things that you have achieved some independence on. You're a reader because you know how to choose books. You know who to talk to about books. You know how to pursue books. And you're not afraid to give up a book that is not doing it for you because you got all these other books that are out there. So let's stop talking about what do kids need to read and start talking about how do we need them to read. And I think we need to pay attention to what's called interpretive versus textual complexity. The Common Core talks about how the textual complexity of books. That's not interesting to me. What's interesting to me is what kids do with the books. And you could read a children's book or a young adult novel or The Hunger Games and meet all the Common Core anchor standards, which are very complex because you're engaging in that interpretive complexity. If you develop that interpretive complexity, then you can read harder books that demand that you have those interpretive skills. Again, if we want kids to be lifelong readers, let's ask them to do what lifelong readers do. And some of that is choosing your own books and having your own reading life.
Mm-hmm. The third approach is create a context that supports pleasure. You may have touched on this a bit already, but
I do have to say that I think if we care about lifelong readers and we care about the kinds of skills and strategies and capacities that lifelong readers have, as shown by the British cohort study, then we have to make pleasure a policy imperative. Now, I talked about inquiry as being a way to create a context where choice is accommodated and kids are being asked to do the work. But here's another example. One of the kids in the study said, great, the English teachers ruin reading for 9 months and then they give you a summer reading plan and ruin it for the summer. Well, why not say during school, look, a little quid and a little quo. I'll read one of yours, you read one of mine. You're going to get non-readers involved, right? Because they're going to want to read the Hunger Games. And then you could go, oh, let's compare it to 1984. And then they've got this shared experience, which they identify with culturally and because of their age, and they get to see how this is a timeless theme. Here's another thing. Give up on the summer reading list and say, let's do a summer reading plan. What is it you want to read? What is it you want to read with your friends? What is it you want to read with your parents? What is it you want to read because you're going on a trip? And and come up with a reading plan that the kids generate themselves, because then you're training them to do what expert readers do, which is create their own reading life.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. We've run out of time. But again, the book is Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them, by Jeffrey Wilhelm and Michael Smith. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, it was a constant pleasure.
Next week, Stefan Bechtel, author of Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.